Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 and KJZZ.org. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. In Valley traffic, 202 westbound, the Red Mountain Freeway, a crash at 24th Street has the right lanes blocked. Also on I-10 westbound, a crash at State Route 143 has the shoulder blocked. Partly cloudy skies for the rest of the day today. Look for a high of 98 degrees with a 30% chance of storms. That sticks around through tonight. Overnight lows in the mid-80s. Chance of rain decreases to 20% tonight. The high temperature increases tomorrow to 102. Right now in Phoenix, with relative humidity of 47%, it's 93 degrees. The Valley's record heat in June is helping the parent company of APS. From the KJZZ Business Desk, Christina Estes reports on Pinnacle West's second quarter earnings.
Pinnacle West says hotter than normal weather boosted earnings, but not enough to offset increased costs for employee benefits, a fossil plant overhaul, and a new customer service and outage management system. Pinnacle West reports total operations and maintenance expenses decreased second quarter results by 19 cents per share. During the month of June, Phoenix set six record highs. APS also reports more customers due to population growth, about 1.5% higher compared to the second quarter last year. Christina Estes, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Just 2 weeks after the Republican National Convention, the Trump campaign will be back in Arizona to stump. Running mate and Indiana Governor Mike Pence will be holding two town halls in the state today. KJZZ's Kerry Young has a few more details about the visit and is with me. So, Kerry, how busy will Pence be in Arizona?
Well, he's got two events scheduled in the state today. He'll begin his day in Tucson addressing supporters at the Fox Theater. He'll then be moving to Phoenix for another town hall-style event at 7 p.m. That's booked at the Phoenix Convention Center in an area that the fire marshal has capped at just over 3,000. And the campaign is issuing tickets to supporters who would like to attend, but there's no word from the campaign on whether they've reached capacity at either venue.
Do we know anything about Pence's message or what he hopes to accomplish with today's visits?
So these are town hall style events. So that means the public gets to ask him questions, and in theory, he could talk about really anything. I asked Brian Sychik, the state director for the Donald Trump for President campaign, yesterday if they had a game plan for how those questions should be chosen, and he didn't really give me much of an answer.
All that'll be worked out tomorrow, and that'll be fully explained tomorrow once everybody arrives.
Okay, so you guys don't have a game plan for that setup?
No, we certainly do, but we're gonna be late to announce all of that tomorrow.
Now, based on the events the Trump campaign has already held this week, I would imagine the message will continue to focus on things that have already resonated well with his supporters, like the economy and fighting ISIS. I'm also expecting we'll hear at least some response to the current feud happening between Donald Trump and the Khan family, the parents of a slain U.S. Army captain. At a town hall in Nevada yesterday, Pence did respond to a question about it, saying he does honor the Khan family, but then he criticized the media for ignoring the mother of a diplomat and Air Force veteran who was killed in the Benghazi attack. She spoke about her son, Sean Smith, at the GOP convention.
That's KJZZ's Kerry Young, who will be covering Mike Pence's stop in Phoenix later this evening. As Governor Pence comes to Tucson and Phoenix, polling analyst Nate Silver's website, 538, gives Donald Trump a 65% chance of winning the state. But some prominent Arizona Republicans, including Senator Jeff Flake, are still not ready to support the GOP nominee. Joining me to talk about this dynamic is Marcus Dellartino. He's a partner at the Phoenix consulting firm First Strategic. And Marcus, what do you think Mike Pence's visit to Arizona says about the state of the presidential race, if anything?
Yeah, I think it's just a product of dynamics. You know, if you're in the neighborhood, why not stop by and get an added press bounce, number one. Number two is I don't think they've spent a whole lot of time down in Tucson, and this provides him an opportunity to reach into the Tucson market. Probably not going to be doing that a lot in the future, and I expect in the next 100, this will probably be the last visit in the next 100 days in Arizona.
Do you buy into the argument at all that Arizona could be in play in the presidential race in November?
You know, anything is up for grabs in this election cycle. It's easily the craziest election cycle I've seen in my lifetime, and certainly probably the majority of the voting Americans. So I would say anything's possible. And you know, largely this race is being defined by factors outside control of the candidates, whether it's a terrorist bombing in France or whatever that computer email hacks, whatever it very well may be, are largely things that are on the voters' minds that are out of the purview, if you will, or control of both Hillary and Donald Trump. So this will be an interesting election cycle. See how they react in the next 100 days.
We saw John McCain this week release a statement that was fairly critical of Donald Trump and his comments toward the Kahn family, who, of course, spoke at the Democratic convention. Several prominent Republicans in the state, including John McCain, didn't go to the convention. Jeff Flake has obviously said that he is not prepared to support Trump yet. Do you get the sense that the Arizona GOP is united at this point? That was such a theme coming out of the RNC in Cleveland. Do you get the sense that the Arizona Republican Party is on the same page?
Well, keep in mind that, number one, I don't think the entire GOP has always been on the same page. You can go back as far as the libertarian leanings of some in the Republican Party versus the more conservative elements of the Republican Party that's been going on for years. And frankly, the same thing is actually occurring in the Democratic Party, as you can see with the Bernie Sanders supporters. So to blindly say that they're united is not true, no. But I think that they're certainly working towards a goal. But, you know, there are problems. Conservatives have problems looking at Mr. Trump as a conservative, just as Bernie Sanders supporters have trouble looking at Hillary Clinton as a credible candidate for them.
There's been a lot of talk so far that the top of the ticket could affect down ballot races. From the Republican perspective, do you think that having Donald Trump and Mike Pence at the top will impact any races, either U.S. Senate, congressional races, corporation commission races, maybe even legislative races? Will they have that kind of effect?
I think largely those races are shaping up to be defined by themselves. I think certainly when you look at the corporation commission race, you're seeing APS versus Solar, and it's certainly less of a Donald Trump versus Hillary Clinton race. The other thing is, I know the Republican Party is going to great lengths to make sure that Republican voter turnout stays, traditionally high and is able to deliver those Republican votes down ballot. But I will tell you that, yes, that is always a possibility. Presidential campaigns do have effect on down ballot races. And when you look, I think, at the history of presidential races, you can see the proof is in the pudding, if you will, how many numbers you may gain or may lose in the U.S. House of Representatives, or certainly the U.S. Senate, can be attributable to the performance of presidential candidates.
Are you finding that Republicans are, even if they're not so enthusiastic about maybe the top of their ticket, they're sort of refocusing their efforts on maybe the Senate race or some of the other down ballot races instead?
Sure, and certainly also the other thing we got to keep in mind is all those initiatives and referendums that we'll be seeing on the ballot this November. You know, those have a lot of money behind them, and we're going to see a lot of TV advertising and a big push to get people to the polls. And those races are often funded very well, millions of dollars to push voters to the polls to vote either for the legalization of marijuana, against legalization of marijuana, up the minimum wage, whatever it very well may be. But that is also a factor that's going to be moving people to the polls in November.
Marcus Dellartino is a partner at the Phoenix consulting firm First Strategic. Marcus, thanks.
Thank you.
A federal judge is set tomorrow to hear arguments in a lawsuit challenging HB 2023, which dealt with elections. KJZZ's Matthew Casey is here with more on this. And Matt, let's start off with the law itself. What does it do?
It makes it a felony for anyone other than an election official, post office worker, family member, household member, or caregiver to collect ballots.
And that basically is a response to political groups, advocacy groups going around and collecting a lot of ballots and then returning them all at once.
Yes, sir.
So what will Wednesday's federal court hearing be about?
Well, there's a lawsuit challenging several aspects of how Arizona does its elections. One of those aspects is the plaintiffs asking a judge to block the so-called ballot harvesting law.
What are their arguments to do that?
Well, the plaintiffs say it discriminates against minorities, especially Hispanics, and that it's just the latest in a long line of the state's systematic targeting of that ethnic group. They argue it's aimed at suppressing Democratic voter turnout. They also say the law violates the Voting Rights Act and the First Amendment right to association. On the other hand, the defendants say HB 2023 modernizes Arizona's election laws, and it's just as likely to impact white voters as minorities. While there's a fundamental right to vote, they argue that there's no right to do it by absentee ballot. They also say it's narrowly tailored to prevent voter fraud, which is an issue the public has expressed concern about.
Matt, what are local elections officials saying about how they plan to implement the law?
They say it has no language on who is supposed to enforce it or how, and they've received no direction from the state. So at this point, it's going to be business as usual on Election Day. Here's Elizabeth Bartholomew with the Maricopa County Recorder's Office.
We're very busy on Election Day. Our poll workers won't be standing by the ballot box if someone comes in with multiple ballots.
Matt, if the state were to give instructions for enforcing the law, would Maricopa County be able to implement it in time for the election?
That's unclear at this point. Bartholomew says they started training staff almost a month ago.
That would kind of have to be a last-minute training for our poll workers. I don't really know how we would implement that.
That's Elizabeth Bartholomew with the Maricopa County Recorder's Office. I've been speaking with Matthew Casey from KJZZ's West Valley Bureau. Matt, thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
In most courtrooms across the country, you don't see them or hear them. Court reporters are silent bystanders in America's judicial process. But currently, there's a shortage of court reporters across the country. And the show's Lauren Gilger found out one Arizona court is using technology to find a way around it.
It is currently 20 minutes after 10.
Attorney Joseph Schenck is sitting in a conference room for a scheduled deposition.
The deposition of plaintiff Joan Clark was properly noticed for 10 o'clock today.
But his plaintiff is nowhere to be found.
Accordingly, I would ask the court reporter to prepare a notice of non-appearance.
In a court case, everything has to have a record. And as he talks, Doreen Sutton is silently typing every word.
You can't hear your typing at all.
No. That's the point.
Sutton has been a court reporter for 25 years, and you may not be able to hear it on her padded keyboard, but she's very good at typing every single word that's said.
Even if they say strike that, even if they say don't put that in there, I still put it in.
Sutton is the secretary treasurer of the National Court Reporters Association. She runs her own stenography firm in the Valley, and she teaches two classes on court reporting for students for free.
I want to get more students in our schools. I think that's how we're going to keep the technology and the viability and the legacy of court reporting alive, quite frankly.
That's because court reporting is a field in crisis.
We are in a shortage.
A big one. The National Association of Court Reporters commissioned a study in 2014 that found that by 2018, there will be a need of about 5,500 court reporters nationwide.
We hear that a lot. Oh, are you guys still around?
The Bureau of Labor Statistics reports there are more than 20,000 court reporters in the U.S., but many of them are retiring, and it seems fewer and fewer students are coming into the field.
The problem with the courts is twofold, I think. One is budgetary, but the other is just finding, especially in the rural areas, reporters that can travel there or be there to report the proceedings.
And many courts around the state say they can't fill their openings. Teresa or Terry?
Terry's fine.
And you are the only court reporter in Graham County, is that right?
In Graham County, yes.
Terry Aguilar has been a court reporter at the Superior Court in remote Graham County for almost four decades. They have two judges and more cases than she can cover.
No, I can't be there in every hearing.
She says unless there's a trial or someone asks for a transcript of a hearing, they use electronic recordings in their courtrooms.
Unless you're from a small town, you don't want to work in a small town.
Pima, Coconino, Yavapai, and Mojave counties all reported shortages or difficulty hiring court reporters in recent years. This year, in Yavapai County, the presiding judge is now allowing early disposition courts in Prescott and Verde Valley to use an electronic recording system instead of certified court reporters. And court administrators in Greenlee and Apache counties said they haven't had a court reporter on staff for years.
We've been experiencing a lot of problems getting court reporters to cover our events.
Eric Silverberg is the court administrator in Cochise County. He says they've been short at least two court reporters for more than 3 years, and until recently, they had to find other ways to fill the gaps.
We would hire freelance reporters and see if they would come down and work a few days or maybe even a week to cover the various court events.
Now the Cochise County Superior Court has become the first trial court in the country to try a new approach.
We realized that we were going to have to find a more of a long-term solution to help us have a more stable supply.
Since May, they've been using remote stenographers. They got funding through the County Board of Supervisors and worked with a company to equip their 100-year-old courthouse with cameras, speakers, microphones, and high-speed internet. Now, court reporters who are certified in Arizona can remotely transcribe court proceedings in real time.
You know, in some cases, you had to continue hearings. Now you aren't continuing the hearings because you have a reporter.
Arizona Supreme Court rules say actual human court reporters are required in the courtroom for a grand jury or a felony jury trial, death penalty murder cases, and in some cases dealing with violent sexual crimes and abortion. But according to Doreen Sutton, the bottom line is simple.
At the end of the day, a human is best. That's all there is to it.
Because when it comes to the law, she says every stroke matters.
I remember I made a mistake early on. I wrote now instead of not, and I went back and corrected it. But things like that can change the whole outcome of a case.
And that is why, after 25 years, she knows there's more at stake in her job than accuracy.
Lives are at stake, cases are at stake, so it's very important that we get a very accurate record.
Lauren Gilger, KJZZ News.
And court reporters aren't only in the courtroom. They transcribe classes or a play for people who are deaf or hard of hearing. And there's a growing need for stenographers to type up the closed captioning on televisions nationwide. Governor Doug Ducey has made deregulation and delicensing hallmarks of his administration so far. This year, lawmakers approved a bill that removed licensing requirements for a number of professions. Jeremy Duda writes about this in the Arizona Capital Times. And Jeremy, let's first run down some of the actions the governor has taken since taking office.
Well, obviously, some of the highest profile stuff, or the stuff that he's really kind of promoted the most, has been revolved around the sharing economy, which Ducey's obviously a big fan of. Now, this past session, there are a few other big pieces of legislation, and one you just mentioned, the occupational licensing, which has become a big issue for him. This bill would have initially eliminated licensing requirements for a handful of professions, landscape architects, geologists, assayers, cremationists, driving school instructors, several others. Now, they removed ended up having to remove a few of those from the bill in the face of opposition, but it was still a pretty ambitious bill, and all signs point to the governor kind of moving forward with similar stuff next year.
On that occupational licensing bill, there was a pretty decent amount of opposition to it, and most of that opposition came from the industries themselves that would have had their licensing requirements taken away, including landscape architects. Was the Ducey administration surprised by that? Did they expect that opposition from where it came from?
I don't think they were probably surprised by that. I mean, they know, you know, the industry groups oftentimes are the ones who push for these licensing requirements, regulatory requirements. And when you have a bill like this that kind of dumps all of them into one big piece of legislation, it's going to be, it can be kind of a tough road that, you have to kind of fight, you know, 8 or 9 or 10 different battles at once in the same bill.
Where does Arizona stand? You did some research on this in your article. Where does Arizona stand as far as licensing requirements relative to other states? And perhaps more importantly, why does that matter?
Well, it matters because this is kind of a gateway to, you know, participation in a profession. You know, in the view of Governor Ducey and a lot of Republicans, this is something that is kind of a roadblock that is, at times unnecessarily thrown up. According to at least one study from the Institute of Justice, Arizona actually ranks pretty high in terms of licensing requirements, meaning that we have more licensing requirements than most other states. Now, that would vary from profession to profession. Some of this is based on relatively unique way that we license contractors in the building trades, is, from what I was told. But our overall regulatory burden, that kind of varies depending on which study you read. Some show us being in kind of the top third of, you know, relatively low regulation states. Others show us a little worse. But the occupational licensing is one that, at least in this one study, stood out. And obviously, the governor has taken notice.
Did you get a sense of what the governor is looking at for next year, like what areas he might try to tackle in 2017?
Well, I would imagine he'll continue with occupational licensing, and I would also guess that there was one big piece of legislation that his office wrote and pushed last session that didn't make it through, that they were quite perturbed about that not passing. It was a bill that would have taken about 19, I think, health profession regulatory boards, moved them all over to the Department of Health Services, and more importantly, what it would have done is it would have given the health services director the authority to accept or reject any new regulations that these regulatory boards and commissions create. There's a good amount of opposition to kind of the breadth of the bill from within among the Republicans, and it ended up kind of dying on the vine in the Senate committee. But this is something that he's very adamant about, and this you may recall that not too long ago he issued an executive order banning state entities from hiring contract lobbyists, and this largely was the genesis of that largely was this this bill that he kind of felt like these entities and other lobbyists played a major hand in killing that.
We should also point out that the director of the Department of Health Services is a gubernatorial appointee.
Yes.
That's reporter Jeremy Duda with the Arizona Capital Times. Jeremy, thanks as always.
No problem. Thanks a lot, Mark.
Nationwide, police departments are not doing a good enough job of protecting civil rights as they relate to body cameras. That's the analysis from a new scorecard released today by the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, a coalition of more than 200 civil rights groups. Three Arizona agencies made the list: Phoenix, Mesa, and Tucson. None fared all that well. Joining me to talk about the results is Scott Simpson, the coalition's media and campaigns manager. And Scott, what were the rankings based on?
What we've seen is very quick adoption of body camera programs as a response to heightened awareness of police violence. And what we're finding is that many departments aren't offering the basic civil rights protections and privacy protections needed to make sure that these are used as tools of accountability. What we're finding is that in many instances, including in Phoenix, that these cameras could be tools of injustice, of enhanced surveillance, and may take rights away from the community and not provide more accountability and transparency.
Did you get the sense that some of those problems are just departments not having thought things through, or is this like actual malice that departments are undertaking here?
Well, so the outcome doesn't require malice or intent. The outcome in a lot of these policies, and again, Phoenix stands out as one of the cities with the policies that have the least protections for citizens. What we're finding is that folks are not able to view footage of themselves. What we're finding is that police are allowed to preview footage before they write their police reports. We're finding that departments are allowing for facial recognition software so that they can map who is innocent people on the street. We're finding that there are a lot of problematic implications for communities that are now under enhanced surveillance because you have body cameras roving in and out of their communities.
Your scorecard looked at three cities in Arizona, Mesa, Phoenix, and Tucson, and it didn't seem like any of them did all that great.
Yeah, so the police departments in Arizona did not do well. Most departments across the nation didn't do well. What we're finding is that we set very clear benchmarks. And when I say we, you know, when body cameras first started rolling out, a group of privacy organizations, a group of civil rights groups, really saw a need to set baseline benchmarks for, you know, what counts as a body camera program that's going to enhance transparency and not infringe on the rights of the people who are being surveilled. And so we set 8 criteria. And those criteria are really straightforward. Does the department make its policy public? Did they interact with the community when developing their policy? Does it say when police officers should turn the cameras off and on, and is it clear about that? Does it ban facial recognition so that of folks who are being viewed? Are police departments allowed to record people who are victims of domestic violence or sexual assault? These are questions that need to be answered because we fear that when used inappropriately, these cameras can make citizens less safe and more vulnerable.
So if, as you say, most police departments around the country are not doing a great job, how do you go about trying to fix that?
Well, you know, so the people of Mesa, the people of Phoenix, they have an opportunity to step up and take a look at, you know, the policies that are doing well and the cities that do have model policies that we think should be used. Really, this is a local matter of national concern.
Are there any agencies that are sort of have model programs or are doing things that you think could or should be replicated elsewhere?
Yeah, there are some in some of the specific categories. There are silver linings, right? There are bright spots in what's a pretty cloudy environment here. In Boston, what you have is the banning of biometric and facial recognition. In Washington, D.C., citizens who have been recorded have a process that they can request to see the footage of themselves. So there are bright spots around the country, but there is no department that really has this all put together.
Scott Simpson is Media and Campaigns Director for the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights. We were talking about the 2016 scorecard the group released on policies around body cameras. We'll post a link to it at theshow.kjzz.org. We also, by the way, reached out to the Phoenix Police Department for its reaction to the report, but as of now, we've not heard back.
It's the show on 91.5. Thanks for listening this afternoon. Along with John Hockenberry at The Takeaway, I'm Mark Brody. This summer's Olympic Games are the first ever to be held in South America. And whether it wants the spotlight or not, the Olympic Games will be a coming out party in the biggest global cotillion of them all for Brazil, a nation that has the capacity on paper to be a superpower, but instead has a per capita income stalled in levels from the 1960s.
But as was the case for other bells to the gold medal ball, Munich, Rome, Tokyo, and Mexico, the chance to be on the world stage, ready or not, is irresistible. David Goldblatt, author of The Games, A Global History of the Olympics, is our guide to the Games this week.
The four Games of the 60s and 70s are all held by nations whose elites decide to make the Olympics a gigantic coming out statement of a process of national development. In the case of, you know, Germany, Japan, and Italy, who host, you know, the Rome Games, the Munich Games, the Tokyo Games, it's saying, okay, the Second World War's over. We're back, and we've undergone the most extraordinary sort of economic boom. Take a look at us. In the case of Mexico, it's we finally arrived. We joined the OECD, you know, and now we're an industrialized nation. We can host the Games. So that's a kind of a different kind of nationalism at work. And I think they have set the tone for, you know, the gigantic Games of the 21st century.
And really, you point out in the book that while we don't want to compare anyone to the Nazis, the techniques that were developed in the 30s by Germany are very much what China uses in the Beijing Olympics to increase this notion of spectacle at the Games. It's absolutely a solid line that can be drawn.
The Germans in many ways sort of set the agenda, but it's worth remembering that, you know, Los Angeles 1932 is just as important. I mean, Carl Diem, who was the man running the 1936 Olympic Games, was notorious in 1932 for badgering everybody with endless questions, taking a million photographs and filling his notebooks with how the LA way, as they described it. And of course, the people running the Games in LA in 1932 are a combination of, you know, the Hollywood elite and real estate boosters, you know, who've spent, as Carrie McWilliams said, the great historian of Southern California, you know, the greatest real estate advertising enterprise in human history is Southern California in the first half of the 20th century. So these are people who knew about how to put on a show. And while they didn't have the kind of money and the sort of insane, pompous grandeur of 1936, in terms of thinking about how do you sell this thing? How do you market this thing? You know, think about it as a show, not just as some sort of obscure, gentlemanly celebration of sport. You know, this is show business.
Distance running, in many ways, was a narrative all about the colony beating the colonial master on the track.
Absolutely. Abibi Bikila, the 1960 Rome Olympics, wins the marathon. This is a man who's grown up, you know, his first job is as one of the guards, the imperial guards for Haile Selassie, the emperor of Ethiopia, a man deposed by the Italian army in the 1930s when they colonized it. And here we are less than three decades later. And Abibi Bikila, you know, barefoot destroys the world record and destroys the field. And on the final run, which goes through the Arch of Constantine, which is pretty good symbolism in and of itself, he actually runs runs past a gigantic obelisk that had been removed from Ethiopia under Mussolini's orders and placed as a kind of, you know, a victory trophy on the streets of Rome. And Bekele runs past it, destroying the field. It's at those moments, you know, that I go, yeah. For all the nonsense, there are moments when the Olympics bring us, you know, transcendent cultural moments of sort of liberation and inspiration. They're few and far between, but they're there.
That's David Goldblatt, author of The Games, A Global History of the Olympics, talking with John Hockenberry, our partner at The Takeaway. A new review study explains how climate change will skew the sex ratios of plants. From the Arizona Science Desk, Melissa Siveny reports for KJZZ that the research team is from Flagstaff.
The study, published today in the journal Nature Plants, looked at dioecious species, plants which have a distinct sex, male or female. Scientists reviewed 83 experiments that exposed them to warmer or drier conditions to simulate climate change. Kevin Holteen of Northern Arizona University and the Desert Botanical Garden in Phoenix is the lead author. He says male plants had higher rates of photosynthesis under stress.
What that means is that those lower rates of photosynthesis in females are going to put them at a greater and greater disadvantage, which we presume will lead to greater rates of mortality.
Holteen says skewed sex ratios will be especially problematic for foundation species in the Southwest, such as cottonwood, willow, and juniper. These trees reproduce slowly and likely won't be able to adjust to the quickly warming climate in the region. I'm Melissa Siveny in Flagstaff.
Climate change is expected to have and is already having an impact on other areas of our ecosystem as well. A new report looks at how plants and animals in the Southwest may fare in the future, and in many cases, the answer is not that great. Jim Hatton is a research biogeographer for the U.S. Geological Survey and the lead author of the most recent report. Jim, what were you trying to figure out with this research?
We were looking at birds and reptiles that commonly breed in the Southwest. So we were real interested in how climate change might affect their ability to breed and reproduce and sustain themselves through this coming century. And we found that about two-thirds of those species are probably going to have some fairly serious consequences to climate change.
When you talk about consequences, are you talking about potential extinction? Is it something slightly less than that, maybe?
Well, for all the species we looked at, we have to first look at the current range of the species, try and understand where they occur and why they occur. And then what we do is we plug in these global circulation models or climate change models, and we project where these species may occur in the future. And then we look at how these species ranges may shift. And about two-thirds of the species, it looks like their ranges are going to contract, some of them very significantly, on the order of 60 to 90% contraction. Others are much less reduced, much less vulnerable. And there are some species, about a third of them, that look like they may even show some range gains. So extinction is not really something we focused on. But it's not out of the question for some of these species where we're looking at range contractions of 70, 80%.
Which are those species which could see their ranges have the largest contraction?
Well, for birds, some of the species where there's large contractions are Brewer sparrow, Williamson sapsucker, sage thrasher. And for reptiles, we see some large projected declines for Arizona black rattlesnake, plateau striped whiptail, chuckwallas, and ornate box turtles.
And when you talk about a species having a smaller range, what are the practical impacts for that species? Like, why does that matter?
Basically, you can think of range as the total area that the species can occupy given the climatic conditions and the vegetation that they're associated with. So one of the important things that we did in this study is we looked at which plant species these birds and reptiles commonly need to just live and exist. And what we found is that the vegetation that these animals are depending on, some of the vegetation is going to decline radically. And as the range of the vegetation declines, the reptiles and birds, even though they might be able to disperse further than where the plants are found, it won't matter, because if they don't have the plants, then they're not going to persist through time.
Scientists have been predicting hotter temperatures, drier conditions, especially in the Southwest, for several years now. Given that, are the results that you found in this study surprising?
When you just look at the effects of climate alone, it's not surprising. One thing that we found that is worth noting is we looked at how fragmented are the species home ranges today, under today's conditions. What we found is the more fragmented those ecosystems are, the more vulnerable these species are to climate change in the future.
Jim Hatton is a research biogeographer with the U.S. Geological Survey and the lead author of research about birds and reptiles in the Southwest and how they may be affected by climate change going forward. Jim, thank you very much.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Niagara Falls may have a famous tourist attraction, but the city is suffering some very tough times. Half its population has deserted the city and is trying to reverse the decline by offering support to newcomers to start businesses and even pay off chunks of their student loans. The BBC's Edwin Lane went to take a look.
The awesome power of Niagara Falls, drawing tourists from all over the world. But the city of Niagara Falls, on the US side of the border, is suffering from years of industrial decline and an exodus of its young people.
Together, we can create independence.
Rethink neighborhoods.
Enable home ownership.
4 years ago, the city began a campaign to bring young people back again, called Live NF. The man behind it is Director of Community Development for Niagara Falls, Seth Piccirillo.
Over the last 50 years, we went from a manufacturing industrial base to a tourism-based economy. So over about 50 years, we lost half of our population, which is, you know, close to catastrophic. And that's why reinventing ourselves now and stemming that loss is about our survival at this point.
Seth's program wants to attract what he calls urban pioneers, young people to come in, buy properties, and start businesses. To entice them, they offer help with finding a home, setting up a business, and crucially help paying off student loans. They're essentially paying people up to $7,000 each just to move here. Two people who've taken up the offer are recent graduates Emery Weber and Kaylee Castetta. I meet them at the Third Street Retreat, a bar cum restaurant they've just opened a few streets from the falls themselves.
You know, I think the biggest thing around here for young people would probably be cost of living. I mean, it's super affordable around here. She was living in New York City, sharing a basement for, you know, the price of our mortgage on our house.
Tell me a bit about your house.
Our house here is great. It's a beautiful five-bedroom house.
That's a lot better than your living arrangement sounded in New York City.
Oh, yeah. I lived with four other girls, shared a bedroom, cockroaches. I mean, they come with New York City. Everything in that house was run down, but that price was crazy.
A beautiful spring day here on 3rd Street in the heart of downtown Niagara Falls. At first glance, it looks like a street full of shops, but if you look a bit closer, most of them are boarded up. There's full lease signs in some of the windows, a couple saying beware of the dog. And it's this street that it's the heart of the regeneration effort here in Niagara Falls. Behind one storefront, an old parole office is being turned into a new coffee shop and deli. Michael Lewis is one of the people behind it. He moved to the area 10 years ago and sees the current regeneration drive as an opportunity to invest.
This building is moving from criminals to cappuccinos.
I'm the nervous one, so I'm the one that's like, oh, is this going to happen on time? Are we going to open this up on time? But in terms of the community, we have one of the natural wonders of the world. You can see the mist from the falls out the back door of our building here. 50 years ago, we used those falls to generate jobs in this area. We're doing the same thing now, just a different kind of job.
So is that enough to slow the exodus of young people from America's Rust Belt? Is the promise of getting onto the property ladder, along with an opportunity to start your own business, enough to compete with the bright lights of the big city? Christopher Mayer is a housing economist at Columbia University.
The problem with urbanization and, you know, the challenges are that the largest cities have become increasingly attractive places to live. And part of this is just being driven by technology. So if you think about all the apps that are sitting on your phone and you ask how has living in New York or London or Chicago or San Francisco changed in the last, you know, 10 years, the answer is I can find restaurants I never knew existed. I can hail a car at 2 a.m. when it was hard to find a cab to come back from somewhere. I can get together with friends. All these different kinds of apps are disproportionately geared towards urban living.
Back in Niagara Falls, Director of Community Development, Seth Piccirillo.
I think an authentic community means support. You feel like there are people around you that are subject to each other, that are there to help you through. And you can't fake community. And one thing I know Niagara Falls has is an authentic community.
That's the BBC's Edwin Lane. It's the show on 91.5. I'm Mark Brody, along with the takeaways, John Hockenberry. The headlines of the civil rights struggle in America were headline news in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. You would never find them in the funny pages. But you may not be aware that in 1957, a 16-page comic book called Martin Luther King and the Montgomery Bus Boycott became a sort of Bible for a group of young people committed to nonviolent direct action in the fight for civil rights. And let's just say this man knows his Bible.
We are tired. We are tired of being beaten by policemen. We are tired of seeing our people locked up in jail over and over again. And then you holler, be patient. How long can we be patient? We want our freedom, and we want it now.
That's Georgia Congressman John Lewis speaking at the March on Washington, D.C. in 1963. He's now the last living member of that era's leaders of the so-called Big Six civil rights organizations. He was head of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And now, as a Yoda-like elder statesman, he has reimagined the comic book of his youth into a graphic novel of his own experiences. The third and final installment of March, a graphic memoir, is out today. Congressman Lewis co-wrote March with Andrew Iden, who's also a digital director and policy advisor to Representative Lewis. Both are here in the studio with me alongside Nate Powell, who's the graphic novelist and artist of March. All three insist that this graphic novel brings the history alive.
Andrew Iden suggested to me that I should write a comic book. I was reluctant, but he convinced me, and I finally said, yes, if you would do it with me. And it reminded me that when I was about 17 and a half, almost 18, I guess, that I read a comic book called Martin Luther King Jr. and the Montgomery Story that told the story of the Montgomery bus boycott. And this little comic book inspired me and many other young people to get involved in the civil rights movement.
So what was your vision?
Well, March came about in the summer of 2008. I was serving as the congressman's press secretary on his reelection campaign. And it was coming down to the end of the campaign, and we started talking about what we were going to do afterwards. Some folks were going to go to the beach. Some folks were going to go see their parents. I said I was going to a comic book convention. And everybody laughed at me, except from the back, I heard a deep voice, and it said, don't laugh, there was a comic book during the movement, and it was very influential. And that was the first time I ever heard about Martin Luther King and the Montgomery story, and it was John Lewis sticking up for me as he stood up for so many. And as I went home that night and read about Martin Luther King and the Montgomery story and learned about it, I became captivated by this idea of a comic book playing a meaningful role in the civil rights movement. And so here I'd spent days and weeks and months listening to the congressman tell the story of the sit-ins, the freedom rides, the March on Washington, the Freedom Summer, even Selma. So I started asking him, I was like, Congressman, why don't you write a comic book? And at first he was very kind, and he said, well, maybe. but I couldn't give up on it. I mean, John Lewis's story was so important, and here I'd grown up in Atlanta. He'd been my congressman since I was 3 years old, and yet I'd never learned the story of SNCC. I'd never heard the story of the young people of the movement. So I started asking, and finally he said, okay, I'll do it, but only if you write it with me. I went on to write my graduate thesis on the history of Martin Luther King and the Montgomery story, basically as a proof of concept that this could work. And what we discovered was that Dr. King actually helped edit that comic book. And so it was our model, because it had played a role in some of the earliest sit-ins, as early as 1958. It had been used by students leading up to the sit-in movement. And then it was spread throughout the country. And so we felt that it was very important to use history as our guide, much as John Lewis did, and frame March in that way. And that's what we tried to do.
So, Nate, what attracted you here to this?
Well, I remember reading a press release about March around 5 years ago or so, and they had already been working together on the script for a couple of years at that point. But it didn't occur to me, really, that the press release had an absence of an artist. And a few weeks later, my publisher gave me a call, and upon his recommendation, I personally tried out for the job with Congressman Lewis and Andrew. So it became a very direct, hands-on experience, getting sample pages of the script, doing demo pages, getting their notes a few days later, redrawing those pages, tweaking those. And within a couple of weeks, we realized we had a really solid team, and the rest is history.
Congressman Lewis, when you would look at the early pages from Nate, what did he typically get wrong?
I don't think Nate got anything wrong. Nate is such a gifted and talented artist. He is able to take the words from the pages and make them jump, make them sing. When I first moved to Atlanta, I became a member of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and his father's church in 1963. And I would go to the church and attend the service while Martin Luther King Jr. would be preaching. And his father would say, make it plain, son, make it plain. Nate, with his pen, is making it plain. He's making it clear. So sometimes when I would look at some of his drawing in book one and book two and now book three, I have to put it down because the images are so powerful. They're so real. He's making it plain.
And you're not interested in just passing the torch to some, you know, Smithsonian archivist. You really want to pass the torch to young people in a way that it's alive.
Well, I want to see young people, not just all over America, but all over the world, standing up to help mold and shape a better society. We did it during the 60s, and young people today can do it.
Andrew, how can you possibly be inspired by the U.S. Congress of today?
Slowly. I think I've been in Congress for 10 years with the congressman, and I can't think of anybody I would rather work for. I think what you learn is that change through Congress is a slow process, and it's about being persistent and consistent, and that's what John Lewis is. Above all else, he doesn't stop, and so you have to have that sort of faith and determination that if you keep putting one foot in front of the other, eventually you will get there.
There's a lot of talk in the campaign, and we'll end it here, about America as the greatest country on earth, and there are plenty of people who say, well, that may be true, but you can't say that until you recognize and atone for slavery, the extermination of indigenous people, and all of the things that Americans have done without really thinking that have resulted in the deaths of thousands, hundreds of thousands, in the case of African Americans, millions of people. When you hear the words, America is the greatest country in the world, how do you process that, John Lewis?
I said to myself, and sometimes I have what I call an executive session with myself, as a country, we're good people, but we've made a lot of mistakes, a lot of blunders. The way we have treated Native Americans, we brought hundreds and thousands of people here in shackles, slaves. And even today, there's still hundreds and thousands of people that have been left out and left behind. The way we treat immigrants, it's not right and it's not fair. It's not just. They have 11 million people or more living in fear rather than moving toward a comprehensive immigration reform. We should do it. In my book, there's no such thing as an illegal human being. When the Pope spoke to a joint session of the Congress, he said, we all are immigrants, and we all are. We have to come to that point where we recognize the dignity and the worth of every human being. As one human being, I would not be pleased or happy or satisfied until we come closer to creating what Dr. King called the beloved community.
Congressman John Lewis, Andrew Iden, and Nate Powell, collaborators on the March Trilogy graphic novel on the civil rights movement, talking with John Hockenberry at The Takeaway. That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.